We'll hear argument in Hudson versus Michigan. Mr. Moran.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, over the last 50 years, courts in virtually every American jurisdiction have suppressed evidence seized inside homes following knock-and-announce violations, including this Court on two occasions. Those suppression orders reflect an understanding of two points key to this appeal. The first point is that the manner of entry, and in particular a knock-and-announce violation, is not somehow independent of the police activity that occurs inside the house. And as this Court directly recognized in Wilson, the reasonableness of police activity inside a home is dependent on the manner of the police entry.
I ask you whether there are statutes in various states that allow an officer to get a no-knock warrant?
Yes, there are, Justice O'Connor.
And does Michigan have such a statute?
I do not believe so, Justice O'Connor.
How common are those statutes?
I believe about half the states have such no-knock statutes. So in Michigan, a police officer, if the circumstances on the scene justify a no-knock entry, then the officer is permitted by case law and, of course, by the precedents of this Court to go ahead and do so.
Why would an officer without such permission want to make a no-knock entry while possessing a warrant?
Well, as this case illustrates, sometimes officers believe that it's to their advantage to perform a no-knock entry or to fail to comply with the knock-and-announce requirement. And that is why. Well, Officer Good apparently thought that his safety would be better served if he disregarded the knock-and-announce requirement, and so he candidly testified at the evidentiary hearing that it's essentially his policy in drug cases to go in without without performing the necessary knock-and-announce. And that was 1 year after this Court's decision in Richards saying that there is no per se exclusion of drug cases from the knock-and-announce requirement. But that brings me to the second reason why courts have almost universally, until the Stevens case in 1999, held that suppression of evidence is necessary, and that is deterrence. Because without the suppression of evidence, there is very little chance that the officers will be deterred from routinely violating the knock-and-announce requirement, from adopting a sort of personal violation of the requirement.
I don't know. I'd be worried, bust in somebody's door that the homeowner wouldn't shoot me without announcing that I'm the police. He'd have every reason to believe he's under attack. Isn't that a considerable deterrent?
Yes, that's the one purpose of the knock and announce requirement that doesn't protect the homeowner's interest, that protects the officer's interest
exactly.
In being shot.
Right.
However, what we'll see then, if there is no exclusion of evidence following knock and announce rules, are entries precisely like the one we have here, where the officers will, in fact, announce. They yelled police search warrant, but then they'll immediately go in. Officer Good said that he went in real fast. He went in, and it took him just a few seconds to get in the door. So that's what they'll do. They'll announce. Some officers will announce because they want the people inside to know that they're police. But they will not wait for a refusal. They certainly will not wait for a reasonable amount of time for someone.
I'm not sure I agree with a point that you make in your brief that civil actions simply are of no use. That might have been the case when we first adopted the exclusionary rule. But our docket is crowded with 1983 cases brought by prisoners, brought by convicted felons. And many of these cases are successful below. What reason is there to believe that that wouldn't be an adequate deterrent?
Simply, Justice Scalia, that as far as we can determine, no one wins a knock-and-announce case, or we haven't been able to find a single case in which someone has actually recovered damages for a knock-and-announce violation. So if
is that because the damages are slight or because there's a defense that is successful? What has been the defense in these tort cases?
Both, Justice Ginsburg. First of all, in many cases, such as this one, where the police don't actually destroy the door, it would be very hard to quantify the damages, and it would be very hard to find a lawyer to take a case such as this. But the second barrier is the various immunities, tort immunities. In Section 1983 actions, there are qualified immunities that make it difficult to win a suit. And because it is not a bright line as to when the police officers have to knock and announce and when they do not, that is there a reasonable suspicion that that a quick entry or a no-knock entry will be met with violence or that the evidence will be destroyed, courts tend to be very generous in granting qualified immunity to officers, that is, concluding that some reasonable officers might have concluded that it was justified to dispense with the knock-and-announce requirement.
Of course, that same problem exists if the consequence is exclusion of evidence. Courts are going to review it the same way. You're not going to avoid that problem by excluding evidence.
Well, there is not a qualified immunity defense to the exclusionary rule. Well, and so if the court concludes —
well, I mean, your point is it's very hard to tell whether they waited long enough, right? And that's why they don't win a lot of these cases. But the same thing is going to be true if the consequence of not waiting long enough is the exclusion of the evidence. The court is going to be very — it's going to be very difficult to tell if they waited long enough. And as you say, the court is likely to say, you know, let it go.
That's true to some extent, Justice Scalia. But as an empirical matter, I've cited many cases in my brief over the last 50 years where courts from a vast majority of American jurisdictions have found knock-and-announce violations in criminal cases and have therefore excluded the evidence, including this court on two occasions, 1958 and 1968. So courts do find knock-and-announce violations in criminal cases.
Our two cases did not raise that issue. The issue was not decided in those cases, was it?
The issue of a knock-and-announce violation leading to exclusion of evidence was decided. There was not an inevitable discovery issue raised in those two cases because those cases predated the inevitable discovery doctrine. But, of course, in 1958 and 1968, this Court was very familiar with the independent source doctrine. And really, the argument that the Michigan Supreme Court has adopted — they call it an inevitable discovery argument — it's really an independent source doctrine.
You don't dispute the application of the inevitable discovery principle here, do you?
Not at all, Justice. Okay. Mr. Chief Justice.
No, and you don't dispute that the purpose of the knock-and-announce rule is not to allow the targets of the search to dispose of evidence or anything of that sort?
Absolutely not. The purpose of the knock-and-announce rule is to protect the homeowner's privacy rights. It's one of the core parts of the right of the people to be secure in their homes against unreasonable police invasions.
Well, but it's a limited privacy right, of course. These people have a warrant, right?
That's correct.
So how would you describe the privacy interest that the knock-and-announce rule is protecting?
Well, I think this Court has described it well in its most recent cases, in Banks and Richards in particular, as well as Ramirez and Wilson, that it is a right against being terrified by having the police come in. It is a right against being embarrassed. People might be in all stages of undress or in compromising positions when the police come in. And it is a right against having one's door destroyed. The early English cases, first recognized that it's a right against having one's door.
So it doesn't go at all to the items that are the target of the warrant. And so why should the remedy for the violation be to exclude those items? The privacy that's protected isn't the cocaine, the weapons, the other items that were discovered.
Well, with respect, Mr. Chief Justice, I think you could say the same thing about the warrant requirement. The purpose of the warrant requirement is also to protect the sanctity and the privacy of the home. It's not to protect the contraband that one might have in the home or whatever it is that the police are looking for.
It's to protect privacy in the possessions and papers and effects. And these are possessions, papers, and effects. It goes right to what the police are trying to seize. And you have an independent magistrate make a determination that there's probable cause to believe it, et cetera, et cetera. The knock-and-announce rule is concerned with entirely different things, and yet you're enforcing it by excluding the papers, effects, and possessions.
And I think courts have recognized that it's necessary to enforce it that way because other methods of enforcing it will not work.
Well,
I think
it's just on the point of the causal relation that the Chief Justice was exploring. I mean, there is a causal relation in the but-for sense. We know that.
Yes.
I suppose the position of the respondent is that the minute there's an entry after the knock violation, the no-knock violation, the minute there's an entry, that injury ceases, so that it's different from a warrantless rummaging around through drawers and so forth. I suppose that would be their argument.
I think that is their argument, Justice Kennedy, and I respectfully disagree with it. As a historical matter, even the early English cases recognized that when an officer a sheriff illegally entered a home with a valid writ, that officer became a trespasser, and the activity that he performed in the home was therefore illegal. In the reply brief, I cited several early American cases from the 1830s and 1840s, holding that when an officer had a valid writ to seize a debtor's goods but illegally entered the home, then that writ became no good. And therefore, the officer, the sheriff in those cases, could be sued not only for the illegal entry, but also for the seizure of the goods that he had a valid warrant or a valid writ to seize. And
but here it was a warrant to enter the home, not to seize particular goods. So the entry of the home was not illegal. The entering of the home was perfectly okay. What was illegal was not knocking and announcing in advance. It seems to me that's quite a different issue, and the causality is quite different.
Well, Justice Scalia, I respectfully disagree that the entry was not illegal. I believe the entry was illegal because what a warrant authorizes an officer to do is to make a legal entry. It does not allow the officer to enter however he pleases. It allows the officer to make an entry that complies with the law, in particular the Fourth Amendment. And so the entry was illegal. They could have performed a legal entry.
I understand that, but the essence of the violation was not the entering. Whereas in the cases, the old common law cases you're talking about, the essence of the violation was the entering. Here the entering was perfectly okay. It was the manner of it, the failure to give the advance notice, that made it bad. And that, it seems to me, creates a different situation.
Well, I think starting in Semaine's case, the court recognized that even if the officer would have a right to knock down the door after a refusal of entry was obtained, that if the officer did not wait for that refusal, then the entry was illegal. And so I think the common law cases do support the old English common law cases, starting with Semaine's case, do support the notion that the entry does become illegal if the officer does not wait for the refusal. And in this case, of course, the officer did not wait at all for any refusal, candidly admitted that he went in as soon as he could get through the door as quickly as he could.
Mr. Moran, would you clarify an answer you gave to Justice O'Connor at the outset of the argument? You said there is no statutory right to get a no-knock warrant. But did you say, as a matter of case law and practice, that can be done in Michigan?
I don't believe so. I don't believe that Michigan still allows for no-knock warrants. But officers, of course, can perform no-knock entries when arriving at the scene. The circumstances justify a no-knock entry.
You mean if you had a case where the reason you were arresting the guy is because he's shot through the door the last three times somebody knocked and announced, you still have to knock and announce under Michigan law?
No, I don't think so, Mr. Chief Justice. I think in that case that would satisfy the Richard standard. In that case, the officer would have particularized suspicions amounting —
But he couldn't get a warrant saying that.
I don't believe Michigan has a procedure for granting no-knock warrants.
That's actually what's disturbing me about this, because I thought the knock and announce rule was a rule that would allow a policeman to go in without knocking and announcing when he has reasonable grounds for thinking he might get shot if he didn't. So as I read the briefs, I thought maybe that's not how it's being implemented, that the policemen are supposed to run the risk of being shot. I didn't think that was the situation, so I'd appreciate your explaining that to me.
Well, in Richards, this court said that if there are particular facts about this particular entry that would make an officer have reasonable suspicions that he is going to be shot at or the evidence is going to be destroyed, then the officer may dispense with a knock and announce requirement. There were no such suspicions in this case, and that's why the prosecution conceded at the outset and at every step since that it was a knock and announce violation. The officers had no information about this particular —
Would it be sufficient if the officer says, one, this is a drug gang, two, they don't let people into the house whom they don't know, and three, they have guns?
That might be sufficient after Richards, but that's not the facts of this case. We have none of those facts in this case. They were serving a warrant, and they had no information that they were going to be in particular danger. They had no information, for example, that there were drugs stored near the toilet that were going to be flushed down.
Let me just be sure I understand. The hypothetical case where three times before there had been a warrant served, and each time the homeowner shot at the officer, the fourth time they could go in without waiting.
I think that would be an easy case, Justice Stevens.
You think it would? Okay.
Because then you have particular facts about this particular residence and the people involved. I think that would be a very easy case for a no-knock entry.
But you can't get a warrant that says he can do that.
I don't believe Michigan has that procedure. Perhaps Mr. Boffman can correct me. He's with the prosecuting attorney's office. But I don't believe Michigan has that procedure. Not all states do have that procedure. And instead, states that don't have that procedure simply leave it to the officer to determine if there are those facts that justify a no-knock entry. So there are many entries in Michigan that occur all the time that do not comply with the knock-and-announce requirement, and that's fine because the officer does, in fact, have the particularized facts justifying a no-knock entry.
We've been down this route before in other cases like Wilson, but it's still a troublesome issue. It's hard for me to believe that if a person has drugs in the pockets of his trousers or on the next to the chair where he's sitting, that he wouldn't immediately run and try to dispose of them. I just think that's ordinary behavior. And if that's so, then it would follow that you never have to knock if you're looking for drugs that might be on the person. Do you have any comment as to that?
Well, then this court, I think, would have to reverse Richards, because Richards said that the fact that it's a felony drug investigation does not justify a blanket exclusion from the knock-and-announce requirement. And this court unanimously held in Richards that the knock-and-announce requirement applies in felony drug cases unless
— But if we say that a likelihood or substantial probability that the evidence will be destroyed allows the no-knock, why won't that be true in every drug case, other than for what we said in Richards?
Well, because in Richards —
Do people say, oh, they've got me now, I won't get rid of the drug?
Well, first of all, Justice Kennedy, I think the law presumes that homeowners will either make an explicit refusal, no, or will answer the door, and primarily that they'll do the latter. The presumption of the homeowner that we're talking about is an innocent homeowner, somebody who is either has nothing to do with whatever the police are looking for. There are many cases where the police are looking for goods that are not connected to the people who are at home.
Well, when there's probable cause to enter, there's no presumption of innocence, is there? Or am I wrong?
Well, with probable cause is a standard that's somewhere around 50%, and a very large number of warrants are executed on the homes of people who have nothing, or people who there is something that the police are looking for, but they don't have anything to do with it. They're third-party homeowners. And for that reason, the knock-and-announce requirement recognizes that many, many warrants, many, many searches will be executed on the homes of perfectly upstanding, innocent people.
Do you have any empirical basis for your statement that many warrants are executed and they don't find anything?
Well, I don't have any statistics. I'm sure the FBI keeps statistics on at least federal warrants. But it's true that in a large number of warrants, the police don't find what they're looking for because probable cause is a standard that is not particularly
high. Do you have any basis for your statement that in a large number they don't find anything that they're looking for?
I don't have any empirical evidence, but certainly lots and lots of anecdotal evidence from reading newspaper accounts of police searches.
You don't dispute the fact that the presumption of innocence survives an indictment, doesn't it?
It does, and I think it survives a search warrant.
Probable cause is not enough to eliminate the presumption of innocence.
I certainly would argue that, yeah. Justice Stevens, that probable cause is not a very high standard, and in many search warrants are, in fact, served on the homes of people who are not suspected because they're thought to be the place where stuff was stored, but not the people who are suspected of doing anything wrong in the first place.
Mr. Moran, these old common law cases you referred to, which held that a failure to knock and announce renders the entry unlawful, what was the consequence in those cases?
Those were cases in which typically the sheriff was sued for trespass.
Right. And the evidence, if found, was not excluded, right?
No.
If we wanted to be faithful to those common law cases, we wouldn't exclude the evidence.
I think things have changed, Justice Scalia, since those common law days for that reason.
And you shouldn't have cited the common law case.
Well Justice Justice Scalia, things have changed in the sense, first of all, that in those days there was a common law writ of trespass. If one were to file in Michigan a complaint for trespass against the sheriff, one would be laughed out of court today because all that you have is a tort suit, which you have to show an extreme violation. I cited the Michigan statute that requires extreme recklessness on the part of the police officer. The second point is that in those days, the sheriffs there were adequate means to control the behavior of sheriffs because they were seen as arms of the judiciary. That, of course, was before the rise of the independent police forces that we have today. And so the exclusionary rule, of course, was adopted in the late 1800s, early 1900s, in part in response to the changing circumstances of the police. The police were no longer under the direct control of the judiciary, and so different remedies were necessary in order to assure compliance with constitutional rights.
In the courts that have allowed this action to go forward, has the rationale been that there is no other effective deterrent to ignoring or violating the knock and announce rule?
Yes, Justice Ginsburg. At last count now, 11 state and federal appellate courts have directly rejected the Michigan Supreme Court's reasoning. The Idaho Court of Appeals just joined the list 2 weeks ago in a case that is not cited because it's so recent. And they have uniformly, I believe all 11 of those cases have said that were we to hold otherwise, the knock and announce rule would become meaningless. A worry that this court expressed in Richards. This court was very concerned in Richards that simply excluding drug cases from the knock and announce rule would make the knock and announce rule meaningless. And these courts have noted that statement, the courts that came down, the decisions that came down after Richards, and have said if that is meaningless, then it would be especially meaningless if we were to exclude the entire knock and announce rule from the exclusionary rule, that there would be virtually no reason for police officers ever to comply with a knock and announce requirement. And so I think the deterrence rationale is a large part of this, and that's what distinguishes this case from the inevitable discovery cases, which the Michigan Supreme Court relied on.
Well, I suppose there are a lot of other violations of constitutional rights by the police that are very hard to get at and that cannot be remedied. And I suppose we could punish them by excluding all the evidence as well. We don't do so simply because there's no causality. We insist upon a causal connection between the two. It's not enough just to say this is the only way to stop the police from making the violation.
No, it is not enough. But what is critical in this case is that the knock-and-announce violation goes to the manner of entry. And the court has long recognized that the two predicates for seizure of goods inside a home or arrests inside a home are authority to enter the home, which is not contested here, and a lawful entry. And if either one of those two predicates is missing, then you have grounds to suppress the evidence. That is, the evidence inside the home is then the fruit of the unlawful entry.
What about our opinion in Ramirez, where the manner of entry was such that there was damage to property? We didn't exclude the evidence there, did we?
No. First of all, this court didn't find that there was a violation in the damage in property. This court did not find, as a matter of law, any Fourth Amendment violation. But I read the Ramirez that language from Ramirez as saying that as long as the entry remains lawful, and in Ramirez the entry was lawful because there were valid grounds to dispense with the knock and announce requirement. You had a known dangerous fugitive who had bragged that he wouldn't be taken alive, and so there was every reason for the officers to dispense with the knock and announce requirement. Therefore, the entry was legal. They had both authority, that is the warrant, and they had a valid entry, that is a no-knock entry that was justified by reasonable suspicion that the officers would be met with violence if they did knock and announce their presence. And so in Ramirez, we have a lawful entry. The language that's quoted from Ramirez directly says the entry remains lawful, or words to that effect, and you have a different case if you
have — What had happened there? They'd broken a window on the way in?
That's correct.
Well, the entry remains lawful despite the fact that the manner of the entry, which included the breaking of a window, was unlawful. I think what the court meant was not, as you're portraying it, that objectively the entry was lawful. I think they were speaking as a matter of law. Despite the fact that the breaking of the window was wrong, the entry was lawful. Just as your opponent is saying here, despite the fact that there was no knock and announce, the entry was lawful.
Justice Scalia, I don't see any language in Ramirez saying that the breaking of the window was unlawful. I think the breaking of the window, I read Ramirez's opinion as saying the breaking.
Even if it was unlawful, it was not unconstitutional.
It certainly wasn't unconstitutional. Often when the police perform a valid no-knock entry, they will damage property. Typically, they will destroy the door. And so the breaking of the window in Ramirez, I don't believe, was unlawful. I believe it was a perfectly valid way for the officer to perform the entry, that is, to put the gun through the window in the garage area in order to prevent — they believed that the homeowner had guns there and was going to run to the guns in order to repel the entry. And so I believe it was a perfectly lawful entry. I think what Ramirez was saying was that not all Fourth Amendment violations bear fruit, and I agree with that. We do not propound here a theory of everything having to do with all Fourth Amendment violations and the fruit that they propound. We simply say that with a knock-and-announce violation that makes the entry unlawful, the evidence found inside the home and only inside the home is the fruit of that violation unless there truly is an inevitable discovery or independent source argument. That is, something independent of the entry, which can't be done here when the police simply barge in and in a matter of seconds, perhaps minutes, find the evidence.
So Mr. Moran, is it undisputed by you that the client would not have disposed of the drugs if the police had waited a few seconds?
Yes, we presume that he would have come to the door. He was just a few feet from the door. In fact, he was right in front of the door. We presume that he would have come to the door, answered the door, admitted the police, and the police would then would have performed the search. If the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Boffman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The metaphor of fruit of the poisonous tree is frequently employed when the exclusionary rule is discussed, and that metaphor is apt. It is apt because the sanction of exclusion, which is not itself constitutionally required, is designed to deter, and to deter in a specific way. To deter by depriving the police of the result, the fruit, the product, the evidentiary advantage that has been gained by their improper conduct. And so,
do you agree there is a knock and announce requirement?
Yes.
Even though there's a warrant?
Yes.
And do you agree that that was violated here, that there wasn't really a knock and announce here?
Yes, there was an announcement, but a failure to wait. There's not — the announcement principles require not only
— Now, is exclusion of evidence in these circumstances a deterrent so that the police would be less likely to do that?
It may be.
Yeah.
But I believe that before the question of deterrence is reached, the question of causality must be addressed. This court has always said that causation is a necessary, though not always sufficient, predicate for the application of the exclusionary rule. The way this court has put it is that it is clear that implementation of the exclusionary rule in particular cases begins with the premise that the challenged evidence is in some sense the product of the improper police activity. So I believe
the
question —
Isn't it the product here? I mean, if they had not entered, they would not have gotten their evidence. Their entry, because it violated knock and announce, was unlawful. So it is a product, isn't it?
I think where I would disagree, Your Honor, is that the entry is lawful. In fact, it's not simply authorized. It's commanded by judicial order. The use of force —
Well, and an entry that conformed with knock and announce would have been lawful. This entry didn't. This entry was unreasonable. So I don't see how your argument fits the facts.
The way I distinguish it, and where I believe the distinction lies, is that what was improper was not the fact of entry. What was improper was the use of force in entering. The knock
but I mean, how do you make that distinction? I mean, it's like the Cheshire Cat and the smile. You can't distinguish the two. There was one entry, and that entry violated the knock and announce rule.
Well, again, the use of force in making the entry violated the knock and announce rule. The entry itself was commanded by the order of the court.
How is that different from saying the entry is lawful? Its only problem is it was done without a warrant. I mean, you know,
because if
inside the building, just unfortunately the means wasn't right, no warrant.
No, if
the means wasn't right, no knock and announce.
If there is no warrant, there is no judicial command to enter. So the entry is completely unjustified. Here we have not simply an authorization.
You might have probable cause, but just not have the warrant. So what is the difference between having probable cause to enter but failing to get a warrant and having a warrant but failing to knock and announce?
Because the Fourth Amendment commands that the police not enter without judicial authorization. The police don't get to make the probable cause decision in advance. And we wish to have a judge make that decision so we won't in hindsight say, had you gone to the judge would have found probable cause, so we'll ratify what you did after the fact. The entry itself, not just the manner of entry, the entry is invalid unless the judge authorizes it or unless some exception exists.
Is it your view the entry was lawful or unlawful in this case?
The fact of entry was lawful.
So in fact,
no, that's not the question. The actual entry was lawful.
The entry was lawful.
Oh, okay.
And the same would be true if what they had was a bazooka and blew the house up.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. The entry would be lawful. The manner of entry would be unlawful, and the consequence of that entry would would turn on what force was used. As in this case, they opened the door and walked in. There was no injury to person. There was no injury to property.
So basically, your argument rests on the fact that we can draw a distinction between entry and manner of entry.
Yes. My principle that I am advocating is that any police error in the execution of a search or in the accomplishment of a search bears fruit only in relation to the purpose or purposes served by the principle violated.
It's a strong argument on the other side that if we adopt your position, the officers would have no incentive other than their own judgment about their personal safety whether to comply with the knock and announce rule.
That is if one assumes that the civil remedy, that the 1983 actions, has no teeth and has no force, and I don't believe that's true at all.
What is the experience in Michigan? The Michigan Supreme Court has had this rule for some time that you don't exclude the evidence. Mm-hmm. How many successful 1983 actions have there been?
I'm not aware of any. On the other hand, like Mr. Moran, other than anecdotal evidence, I have no statistical evidence that the police are violating the knock-and-announce principle since the decision in Stevens.
But you have not even one case that you can cite where a 1983 remedy was resorted to and was successful.
In Michigan, I don't. There are cases cited in our brief where, in fact, there are actions brought. There are several recent decisions in the Seventh Circuit, for example, where qualified immunity was denied on a knock-and-announce violation in the cases in the district court for trial or settlement. And there may be many cases that don't make the reports where actions are brought and settled.
You're not aware of any case?
I am not aware of any case. And again, I think Mr. Moran correctly points out in many of these cases are resolved by finding that the Richards v. Wisconsin exceptions have been met. It is not, to me, remarkable that there are not a lot of civil actions. I believe there are not a lot of violations. Because while no-knock entries may occur, they are justified under Richards v. Wisconsin in most cases. This case is an aberration.
On the no-knock warrant, do you agree that it's not possible to get one in Michigan?
Yeah, there is no statute in Michigan where one can go to the judge in advance and say, here are the facts known to me already before I even get to the scene that should justify a no-knock. That doesn't exist in Michigan. Michigan follows Richards v. Wisconsin and had case law even in advance of that, which simply said whether known in advance or whether the facts occurred at the time of the execution of the warrant, if the Richards exceptions are met, you can go in without knocking and announcing. So we do follow that rule. You just simply can't get advanced judicial authorization. It doesn't exist. But it is certainly permissible, and as Mr. Moran indicated, it happens on a fairly regular basis because unlike Mr. Moran, I believe the notion that even in this case, I'm not saying there was no violation. There was a violation because the police didn't know in advance that the defendant was sitting in a chair with cocaine in his pocket on the chair in front of him and a gun by his side. I think that he would have answered the door is highly speculative and somewhat fanciful in that circumstance.
Do they get to make inevitable arguments on their side? I mean, let's say as what happened here or as seemingly happened, the fellow was found near the chair with the drugs. Can't they argue, well, if you'd knocked and you'd waited 10 seconds, he would have gotten up from the chair and gone somewhere else, and you wouldn't have been able to argue at trial he was sitting in the chair with the drugs?
That's true, but the drugs were, in this case, the drugs were in his pocket, so it wouldn't have helped
him.
Something
in the chair, right? I mean, there was the gun or what?
The gun was in the chair, but he was only convicted for the drugs in his pocket.
Hmm.
I don't think he could say if you would have I would have gotten up and answered the door, and therefore you wouldn't have had to come in without knocking. You wouldn't have had to break the door. You wouldn't have had to scare me.
You wouldn't have been able to tell the jury I was standing next to the chair, because if I obviously would have gotten away from the chair because I knew that's where the guy was.
That may well be, and I want to be clear. I am not here arguing that this court should decide that there is no circumstance possible where something that occurs in the premises is not causally connected to the failure to knock and announce. All I'm asking the court to decide is that causation is required before the exclusionary rule is implemented, and physical evidence found within a proper search or search of proper scope pursuant to the warrant, that is not causally connected to the knock and announce violation. There may be other evidence.
So you think it's possible that the defendant could argue that the evidence should be excluded because had he knocked and announced, I would have run to the toilet and flushed it down rather than
no,
answer.
No,
well, why not?
I think the only thing
that's causal.
But I think you have to tie the causal connection to the purposes, as I have tried to indicate, to the purpose or purposes served by the principle violated. What is the purpose of knocking and announcing? And I think Your Honor indicated it's to protect against injury to the police, injury of people inside and property. It has no purpose to protect against the invasion of the privacy of the dwelling and the discovery of the evidence. In fact, if the police knew in advance that the defendant might flush the drugs down the toilet, they wouldn't have to knock and announce at all. So I think we have to relate the causal question to what is the principle violated, what purposes does it serve, and in the case of knock and announce, it does not serve the purpose of allowing evidence to be destroyed. That, in fact, serves as an exception to knocking and announcing at all.
What do you say the purpose of knock and announce is?
This Court has identified it on several occasions as to avoid unnecessary violence to the property, avoid unnecessary possible injury to people, both to the officers who are executing the warrant and people inside, and to allow the person inside to prepare to answer, as Mr. Moran indicated, if they might be in a state of undress or something, they could avoid that embarrassment.
So I take it your argument is that except in cases in which the people inside the house are not dressed or cases in which there is, in fact, a gun battle of some sort, that a knock-and-announce violation will, in fact, never be the cause of any damage at all.
It will never be the cause of the discovery of the physical evidence.
No, but it will never be the cause of any compensable damage at all.
Well, if a —
Because I take it your argument is what you can recover from requires causation. And what I mean by causation is the causation of the harms which the rule is intended to avoid.
Correct.
And if the only harms that the rule is intended to avoid is the exposure of nakedness and violence once inside, and there are cases without nakedness or without violence, then in those cases there will never be a recovery.
Oh, in those cases, correct. In cases where there is violence, there will be recovery. In a case such as the instant one, where there is no nakedness, there is no violence, they simply open an unlocked door, I would say, yes, there would be no recovery in that circumstance. There would be no damages. There may be cases, and this is why not, I'm not arguing there was no knock-and-announce violation, and that the police shouldn't knock-and-announce, because in different cases, the consequences may be dramatic. They may be severe, and damages may be severely assessed.
But basically, your rule is the police are entitled to take the chance. If they get inside and people have got their clothes on and there's no gun battle, no problem. Nothing that the police are exposed to, either by an exclusionary rule or by a civil recovery. And if they want to take that chance, if they want to take the chance that somebody will not be dressed or a gun will be pulled, basically that's their option.
I think, as in other situations where this Court does not apply the exclusionary rule simply on a deterrence basis, because the Court does not always apply the exclusionary rule, even when there would be deterrence, that is correct.
Well, that's not true. I mean, there are going to be situations, or at least possible, where evidence is going to be causally connected to a violation of the knock-and-announce rule, right? The situation — the warrant is because these people were involved in a shootout with the Johnson gang. They knock the door down and somebody yells, "Look out, it's the Johnson gang."
Yes.
And if they had knocked and announced and it's the police, they wouldn't have that statement. That's incriminating. Now, you would agree that that statement would be excluded because of the violation, right?
Yes, exactly. That was precisely the point I was going to make in terms of a hypothetical. We're not arguing, as I tried to indicate earlier, we're not arguing that you need to resolve every question today about what is or is not causally related. And there are circumstances where a spontaneous declaration, you know, the police break through the door and the defendant says, "The drugs are in the closet," and you want to use that declaration to tie him to the drugs, that may well be causally connected. All we're asking today is for this Court to decide that the items, the physical evidence found within a proper scope, a search of proper scope of the warrant that's being executed, is not causally connected. Other questions of spontaneous declarations, tying the defendant by position to the chair, those may present different issues. But the drugs that were named in the search warrant as items to be searched for and seized are not causally connected. They are the fruit of the execution of the judicial command, not of the knock-and-announce violation.
I can understand the requirement that there be causal connection. Are there cases in which courts have held that there was a knock-and-announce violation and there is a general remedy of exclusion unless, except when there's a causal connection. But in fact, the evidence was admitted because it was not causally connected to the entry?
I'm not aware of any.
I mean, I can understand the hypothetical, but it seems to me it's really a hypothetical.
And I think the reason that that exists is because up till today, and Mr. Moran's correct, most courts go the other way, up until the Stevens case, the assumption had been, and I think the assumption has come from Miller and Sabbath, the assumption has been if there's a knock and announce violation, you exclude the evidence. So questions of causation have not been explored until the Stevens case, and then the Seventh Circuit, in several opinions, has also reached the same conclusion. But I think Sabbath and Miller present very different circumstances. Sabbath and Miller, as the Court will recall, were arrest cases. And the rearrest situation does not translate into the execution of a search warrant because knock and announce serves a different purpose, an additional purpose in the arrest situation that is not served in the search situation.
I see your argument now. I think your argument is most of the Fourth Amendment rules are really designed to prevent warrantless entries. But this one isn't.
That's correct.
This one is designed to prevent damage to property.
That's correct.
So let's not have the exclusionary rule and rely on the damage remedy where that kind of thing actually occurs, which isn't often.
That's correct.
If we buy that principle, suppose we were to apply it in the Miranda area. The purpose of a Miranda warning is really to make certain he can have a lawyer if he wants one, for example. So now we prove this guy wouldn't have asked for a lawyer anyway. All the evidence comes in. I mean, it's an interesting principle. I see the logic. But it seems to me to have a lot of implications that this Court has never bought.
I think it's much more speculative in the Fifth Amendment area, but I think
can't think of any other area, Fifth or Fourth, where we've bought it, and I've tried to explain in the question why we haven't bought it. Now you go ahead.
But I think to not accept causation as a requirement, which I think this Court has always done, as I said at the outset, this Court has said that implementation of the exclusionary rule is premised on the evidence being the product of the police misconduct. To not do that, to not have a causation requirement, I believe, severs this Court's current exclusionary rule doctrine from its moorings. There are many circumstances that this Court has, at this point at least, seen fit to rest with the lower court, such as the execution of a search warrant. You search within proper scope. You're looking for computer monitors. You find them. But as you're executing, you open a desk drawer and you shut it. You exceed the scope of the warrant. The law is pretty uniform currently that you don't suppress the computer monitors because you exceeded the scope by opening the drawer. If you found drugs in the drawer, you'd exclude those. But you won't exclude the monitors because there's not a causal connection between the wrong in exceeding the scope of the warrant and the discovery of the monitors. All those cases are up for grabs again if this Court severs the causation requirement from the application of the exclusionary rule. And that's just one example. There are others. This Court has always required that there be a causal connection, and I believe that it should simply continue to do so. We're not asking this Court to overrule any cases, to create any really new principles. We're simply asking this Court to understand that Sabbath and Miller were not going to announce for arrest. With an arrest situation, if a person surrenders at the door, you don't go in and search the premises thoroughly. There's a different purpose served in arrest. With a search warrant, knock and announce has no purpose of protecting the privacy of the dwelling itself with the discovery of the items named in the warrant, and they shouldn't be suppressed. Things that are causally connected can be left to an argument that may be made by counsel in different situations. But as to the items named in the warrant, contraband, fruit, spirits, instrumentalities, that should not be suppressed. It is simply not causally connected to the entry, and we would ask this Court to so hold. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Salmon.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. The knock and announce rule, unlike the warrant and probable cause requirements, does not protect the individual's privacy interest in the items to be searched and does not relate to the officer's authority to conduct the search and obtain the evidence. An unannounced or premature entry, therefore, does not detract from the officer's legal authority reflected in the warrant to enter and conduct the search. Instead, as this Court held in Segura, an untainted warrant provides an independent source for the search, even where the entry is illegal. There was only one entry in the Segura case, since the officers remained in the apartment until a warrant was finally obtained.
It depends, of course, on whether you want what you're doing. Now I see what you're doing. You're applying a kind of Paul's graph causation analysis within the risk. I think that's what you're doing, to saying it's outside, it's not a cause. You're saying, you don't say it's not a necessary condition of his being there. It is. You do say, well, the being in the room there is not within the risk, the reason for which we have the knock and announce rule. But, of course, that's a matter of judgment. I mean, you could say the purpose of the cause of the knock and announce rule is to keep people out of there without knocking and announcing. And if that's the purpose of it, it's right within the risk, right cause.
Your Honor, just
are looking at the harms that his being there in that room without announcing might bring about. That doesn't mean that's why we don't have the rule. We have the rule to keep him out of there without announcing.
Your Honor, there are several reasons why the court has articulated several reasons for why there is the knock and announce rule. We think the important point, though, with regard to the Segura case, is that the entry in Segura was unlawful both because the officers did not announce and because they did not have a warrant. They nonetheless stayed there for 20 hours, and when they finally did obtain a warrant, they conducted the search. And this court had no difficulty in saying that even though the initial entry was unlawful, the warrant authorized search, the warrant was an independent source for the search, and that the legality with regard to the initial entry was, quote, wholly irrelevant to the evidence that was obtained pursuant to the warrant. And we would submit that it would be an odd Fourth Amendment rule that would allow admission of the evidence where the officers failed to obtain a warrant. They entered without a warrant and without announcement and only later obtained one, as in Segura, and then suppress all evidence in this case where the officers did obtain a warrant in advance and their only illegality was the much more minor one of entering a few moments prematurely.
What was in this court's cases. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's fine, Your Honor.
I was going to say, what were the grounds upon which the warrant in Segura was obtained?
The warrant in Segura was obtained based on evidence that was in existence prior to the unlawful entry, so that it was an untainted warrant.
So it didn't depend on the entry or anything gained as a result of the entry, right?
Well, of course, the officers, once that warrant was obtained, officers would have to enter the apartment in order to conduct the search.
Right, but
except for the fact that they had already entered illegally and were already present illegally in the apartment.
The warrant itself didn't depend on anything they had gained as a result of the entry. There was no cause continuum there.
That's absolutely correct. That's a requirement.
Isn't that the difference, though, with this case? Because here there is a causal continuum, at least, as Justice Breyer said, a but-for causal continuum. They wouldn't have been in the apartment but for the entry. And so the authority of the warrant and the manner of executing the warrant are not divisible the way they were in Segura.
Your Honor, with respect, I think it would be an improper reading of Segura. There was an illegal entry in Segura that was just as necessary in order to conduct the search and obtain evidence in that case as there was a premature entry here.
But in Segura, the court issuing the subsequent warrant says, you can go in there and do this. The court by the way, I maybe this makes it even easier. Did the court in Segura know that they were in the apartment?
No, Your Honor. Okay. They had no knowledge of the illegality, and the evidence that was the basis for the affidavit for the warrant was untainted by the illegal entry. Of course, the same is true here. There's no allegation at all that the warrant in this case
is just
tainted.
I'd appreciate your explaining this. This seems to me what you're saying in your brief was the inevitable discovery. The inevitable discovery rule, the way I've thought of it, and I'd like you to correct me if I haven't thought of it correctly. To use a kind of analogy, it's like a primitive tribe that beats a tom-tom every morning so the sun comes up. Hey, the sun's going to come up anyway. And the bodies are going to be discovered anyway in those cases. And in Segura, the warrant is going to be issued anyway. So it isn't a question of whether it would have been issued if they'd behaved properly. It's a question of what will really happen in the absence of the illegality. Well, now, that's what I thought inevitable discovery here was, and in the absence of these people entering the apartment illegally, they wouldn't have found a thing because there was nothing else in motion.
Your Honor, with respect, that is directly at odds with the way the court in Segura approached.
Which case is contrary to what I said?
I think Segura is contrary to
Segura,
that.
Segura,
you just said that
in Segura they would have gotten in anyway under a legal warrant that had nothing whatsoever to do with the illegal entry.
In fact, that's precisely the analysis the court undertook in Segura. It said if there had been no illegal entry, the officers would have obtained the evidence in the same way.
Well, not would have, did.
Well, I'm just informing Your Honor what the Segura case says. It says the officers would have found the same evidence that they found pursuant to the warrant if they had complied with the Fourth Amendment. That's because the court viewed that warrant as a separate, independent source for the authority to enter and conduct the search. One would have to posit, I guess, that the officers in this case, if they would rather not execute the warrant than delay a few additional moments before entering, but I think that would not be a very realistic hypothesis.
Then your position is that you never, if you have a warrant, then you can seize what the warrant lists. So if you have a warrant, then there is never a reason that the police would have to knock and announce, because the warrant gives them independent authority to enter. That seems to be what you're saying, that as long as you have a warrant, the knock and announce does not have to be complied with.
No, Your Honor. The knock and announce requirement is we take no issue with that. That is required by the Fourth Amendment. With regard to deterrence.
In this very case, you had an officer who said it was his regular policy never to knock and announce, just go in. So if the rule you propose is adopted, then every police officer in America can follow the same policy. Is there no policy of protecting the homeowner a little bit?
Of course,
the sanctity of the home.
Of course there is, Your Honor, and that is not our position, and we respectfully would argue that that's not an appropriate way to conduct the deterrence analysis. Even just on the terms of deterrence, we think that suppression here would be a disproportionate remedy, and that's because, as this Court has repeatedly recognized, the officers already have an incentive inherent in the nature of the circumstances to announce and delay some period of time before entering. Now, there may be
What is this incentive inherent in the circumstances?
It's not to be mistaken for an intruder and shot at, Your Honor.
Well, it doesn't seem to work. This is a case in which the officer testifies, it never works. I always go in.
That's not really — I mean, to be fair, Your Honor, that's not what he testified to exactly. What he said was he's been shot at several times, and he went in early in this case in part because of his safety concerns. But he didn't speak to any broader policy. But in any event,
What reason do we have to believe that this incentive inherent in circumstances is ever going to work in the absence of an exclusionary rule?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are several reasons. One, and again, this Court — these are all of the things I'm going to list come from this Court's cases, including Nix and Murray and Segura, where the Court has applied the doctrines we ask the Court to apply here. And what you have is the inherent incentive to knock and announce because of their own safety concerns. We think the only thing that might not cover in terms of deterrence would be the additional few moments you may want them to wait. They will announce, and they will delay some period of time. Now, in the absence of concerns about safety or destruction of evidence, the officers have nothing to gain by entering prematurely. And so in doing a deterrence analysis, I think it's important to keep that in mind. It's not like there's a huge gain for the officers when they don't have legitimate concerns.
Why don't they have something to gain? If they're right that there is evidence inside, they gain they're perfectly rational in this. They gain a greater chance of getting that evidence than if they let a few seconds elapse and the evidence can be flushed away.
To be sure, Your Honor, there are times when they may miscalculate the nature of the concerns about safety and destruction of evidence. But in cases where there aren't those concerns, they have nothing to gain. And in addition, entering prematurely may make them a defendant in 1983 or Bivens actions, which I'm sure that no officer relishes.
For which there is no record of any recovery in any court in the United States. Isn't that correct?
May I answer, Your Honor?
Sure.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that, and I would point the Court in particular to a recent case out of the Seventh Circuit, Jones versus Wilhelm. The Seventh Circuit has announced the position and decided the position that we advocate. There are many cases, Your Honor, the courts are replete with them, where people bring those types of claims and win, and then they settle.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Moran, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. First of all, as to the evidence that is causally connected to the knock-and-announce violation, there are two reasons why the remote possibility of such evidence will never deter police officers from violating the knock-and-announce requirement. The first is that it's very remote. I'm not aware of a single case in American history where there has been identified such evidence that is directly causally related only to the knock-and-announce violation. But the second reason, more fundamental, is that even if there were such evidence, by definition, the possibility of finding such evidence will not deter the police from committing a knock-and-announce violation, because they wouldn't have found that evidence had they complied with the knock-and-announce requirement. In other words, the police would only gain that evidence by committing the knock-and-announce violation, so there would be nothing lost in going ahead and risking an excited utterance that they wouldn't be able to use, because by definition, they wouldn't be getting that excited utterance anyway. I think it's important with the Solicitor General's brief to rebut the claim that Miller and Sabbath had something to do with the fact that there was no warrant in those cases. Nothing in Miller and Sabbath turned on the absence of a warrant. And in fact, in Miller, the court specifically said, the requirement stated in Semaine's case still obtains. It applies as the government here concedes whether the arrest is to be made by virtue of a warrant or when officers are authorized to make an arrest for a felony without a warrant. The government conceded in Miller that whether there was a warrant or not had nothing to do with the knock-and-announce violation in that case.
I thought the government's distinction was based on the fact that they were arrest cases. I thought that's the distinction they were making.
Perhaps I misread their brief, Justice Scalia, but I thought it was that there was an absence of a warrant. Of course, this is an arrest case as well. Mr. Hudson was seized and was searched incident to arrest. And so this was also an arrest case, much like Miller and Sabbath. As for the causal connection argument, if this court were to accept it, I listed in my principal brief a litany of cases that I think would have to be overruled. Katz, Knowles, Silverthorne Lumber, for that matter, Kylo. All those cases say that it doesn't matter that the government has a clear, lawful route to get the evidence. The fact that they didn't follow that clear, lawful route prevents the government from using that evidence. And it's impossible to explain how Mr. Boffman's causation theory is consonant with all of those cases.
Isn't the reason it's consonant? It's because in those cases there is the connection in terms of the purposes of the rule that was violated and the evidence that was seized?
Mr. Chief Justice, I think the same thing applies here. I think that the knock-and-announce rule is about the sanctity of the home. And this Court could not have said it any more clearly in Wilson that the reasonableness of a search or seizure inside a home is connected to the method of entry. In fact, the Court said it three times in Wilson in various ways. And so I think it is the purpose of the knock-and-announce rule is to protect the homeowner's right of privacy against shock, fright, and embarrassment that can come with a precipitous police entry.
But not the general privacy of the home, because you don't dispute that if he had waited an additional 4 seconds, he could have entered the home and executed the warrant.
No, we don't dispute that at all, Mr. Chief Justice. Finally, I have to ask why this Court has decided all of these knock-and-announce cases in the last 10 years, if my opponents are right. This Court shouldn't have — they were all criminal cases, and this Court should have simply said the petitioners or respondents, as the case may be, cannot obtain the relief they are seeking because the knock-and-announce rule is not causally related to the evidence that they're trying to suppress. And so if this Court were to adopt my opponent's position, the knock-and-announce rule will become a dead letter. There will be virtually no cases. There will be virtually no more development of this rule. This Court would have been wrong in Miller. It would have been wrong in Sabbath. And it was wrong to reach the substantive constitutional questions it reached in Banks, Richards, Ramirez, and Wilson. And all the other courts, virtually every state, is currently suppressing evidence seized after a knock-and-announce. Well, they would have to be wrong, too. And so a lot of courts, including this Court, have been wrong a lot of times, if my opponent is correct. Finally, one last word on Segura. Segura is the sort of case where one can make a respectable, inevitable discovery, in fact, a winning inevitable discovery or independent source argument. But the key thing in Segura is this Court did not disturb the fact that the evidence that was seized during the initial entry was suppressed, because that was directly connected to the unlawful entry. And so the evidence that the police initially seized before the 19-hour wait in Segura was suppressed. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.